Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I'm so glad you made it. Your panel for this afternoon is to my right, Justice Lee Gabriel, to my left, Justice Bonnie Sutterth. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have two cases set for oral submission on the 1:30 docket and then one case on the 3 o'clock docket. We'll take a break before the 3 o'clock docket. And everything else is set for oral submission. Understand both sides are ready? All right, if you call the case, we'll get started. Go by Carson?
Yes.
All right, you're up.
May it please the court. The issues that we're dealing with today concern a motion to compel arbitration that was denied in the Hood County District Court. I represent Granite Ray, which is a surety. Mr. Burke represents J. Mills Contracting, who was a general contractor, and the another party who's not involved in this appeal is NAMI, who was the subcontractor. Granite Ray was the surety for NAMI. NAMI was subcontracted by J. Mills to build a boardwalk and dock in Granbury. There was an allegation of default, and J. Mills has brought claims for breach of contract on a performance bond against Granite. We filed a motion to compel arbitration, and that was denied, and we are here today on appeal on that issue. Basically, the contractual structure, what we have is what's called a chain of contracts. There was a blanket agreement, basically a master subcontract agreement that was entered into, or allegedly entered into by J. Mills and NAMI. Pursuant to that blanket agreement, there was a work order. And the blanket agreement included an arbitration clause. It says any and all disputes, claims are to be arbitrated as long as they arise out of or relate to a work order. A work order was entered into for the boardwalk that I just mentioned. Things fell apart, and J. Mills ultimately sued NAMI after settling a dispute with the city of Granbury. They also sued Granite under the performance bond. Our position is we have a bond that expressly incorporates the work order. The work order expressly incorporates the blanket agreement, and the blanket agreement includes a all-encompassing, very broad arbitration clause. So from our perspective, Granite and J. Mills are required to arbitrate their claims as to one another because you have a chain of contracts that flow down, each incorporating the one above it or below it, depending on your perspective. So there is, in fact, an arbitration clause that exists between Granite and J. Mills. I was unable to find any directly on point Texas cases. There are a fair number of cases directly on point from other jurisdictions. I have cites in the briefing to, I believe, the First Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, the District Court for Maryland. All have very on-point factual scenarios that talk about the situation, where the surety's bond incorporates by reference the ascending contract chain that includes an arbitration clause that says the obligee under the bond is required to arbitrate with the surety. That gets into the whole incorporation by reference argument, which is point one in our appeal. Basically, you have policies, Texas policy, federal policy, all favor arbitration. If you were to cut in favor of one side, it is in favor of arbitrating it. The incorporation by reference argument is one prong of our argument. The second is this more equitable argument, a form of equitable estoppel called direct benefit estoppel. The argument there is essentially that J. Mills can't take advantage of contractual provisions in the blanket agreement and the work order by suing the surety without being bound to all of that. You can't cherry pick which clauses control and which ones don't. So our argument on the direct benefits estoppel.
Did you raise that in the trial court?
Yes.
You raised direct benefits estoppel in the trial court.
I made a reference to it in the reporter's record, and it's got a citation to it in the motion to compel. That is in there. There's a footnote referencing cases on equitable estoppel, and I say it, and I also pointed out that Jay Mills was bound to arbitrate under equitable estoppel, the direct benefits form. There is a footnote in the motion to compel arbitration. I did raise that issue at the argument before Judge Walton.
Okay.
But I mean, the argument there is you can't have a part of the contract. You can't say Granite is liable under the bond because NAMI defaulted on the subcontract, but we're not bound to the arbitration clause. These things are all intertwined. You can't separate out the bond with that. I mean, the only possible way there's liability on the bond is if NAMI defaulted under the subcontract consisting of the blanket agreement and the work order. So their claims have to arise from or relate to the blanket agreement and the work order. You can't have the bond without that. And so our position is, as long as they're suing us on the bond, they're bound to the arbitration clause in the blanket agreement and the work order.
Didn't the arbitration clause specifically accept claims for indemnity?
The argument to that, there is an exception in the arbitration agreement that Jay Mills relies on, or you can call it an exception, which is you can't force someone to arbitrate if they don't have an arbitration agreement. Our first response to that is there is, in fact, an arbitration agreement. The second part, of more directly on point to your question on the indemnity claim, is they're not suing us for simply indemnity. They've got three components of their breach of contract claim, which they framed as a breach of contract claim, arising from NAMI's alleged failure to timely prosecute the work, NAMI's alleged failure to timely complete the work, and NAMI's alleged failure to indemnify Jay Mills.
But their claim against you is only on the bond.
Correct. But the breach of contract claim on the bond flows only and solely from NAMI's alleged breach of the underlying contracts and from the bonded contracts.
They paid money to finish the job that they say NAMI didn't do, correct?
They paid money to the city to settle a claim that the city had against them.
They paid money, and they want to be reimbursed or indemnified for that from the surety, correct?
Correct.
And that is their breach of contract action, is a breach of the performance bond.
Correct. I guess I don't see it as a claim for indemnity. I see it as stemming from NAMI's alleged breach for failures to do much more than simply indemnify. I mean, all Granite is doing is, I mean, the bond is intended to supplant Granite for NAMI, so if NAMI doesn't perform its obligations, being completing the job, timely prosecuting, indemnifying, that Granite is supposed to step in and do that under their theories. So, in my mind, based on their own pleadings, they're not limiting it to indemnity. And then as the backdrop to all of that, even if they were limited to indemnity, the fact is we still have an arbitration agreement with them, because it's not like Granite is some isolated party with no connection to this. It essentially stands in the shoes of its principal, NAMI, on all of these claims. So
Even if they were limiting it to indemnity, but the arbitration clause specifically accepts indemnity claims.
If there's no arbitration agreement already existing, but yeah, yes, I mean, the arbitration agreement says contribution and indemnity claims can be arbitrated or not arbitrated as Jay Mills elects, as long as there's not an existing clause between the parties. Our position is there is an arbitration clause between the parties, and beyond that, the claim's not simply for indemnity, it's for more than just that. That's the argument in response to the exception that they raise.
What is it for in addition to indemnity? If that's, I mean, they're not asking you to finish the job. They're not asking you to, it's been done. Somebody else has done it. They're just asking you for indemnity, right?
I'm going off of their pleadings. I mean, they are asking to be paid back for what money they paid to the city of Granbury to settle Granbury's claim with Jay Mills. And stemming from NAMI's alleged failure to perform its contractual obligations consisting of prosecution of the work, completion of the work, and indemnification of Jay Mills. I mean, to me, when we boil it all down, the issues, I don't see how there's not an arbitration clause. The clause encompasses everything, I mean, I don't think there's an issue. If the dispute were between, if the only parties to the case were J Mills and NAMI, there would be absolutely no question that they would have to arbitrate it. I mean, that's the whole arbitration clause. Now, granted, as the guarantor bonding company surety for J Mills, or sorry, for NAMI, substitutes in for NAMI, there's plenty of case law. The direct benefits estoppel, they fit in, they basically substitute for NAMI. So if J Mills has to arbitrate with NAMI, J Mills has to arbitrate with Granite Ray.
Well, okay. But they would sue NAMI for breach of contract, and they would sue you on the contract for indemnification.
They've sued both NAMI, or NAMI has been non-suited. Originally, they sued NAMI and Granite Ray for the same things. NAMI's failure to perform under the work order and the blanket agreement.
Breach of contract. Breach of contract.
Correct. And then they've sued Granite Ray for breach of the bond, which incorporates the work order, which incorporates the blanket agreement, also for breach of contract. And they haven't, I mean, not trying to get into the issues of semantics on whether they said we're suing you for indemnity or suing you for breach of contract. They sued everybody for breach of contract, a component of which is NAMI's alleged failure and Granite Ray's alleged failure to indemnify J. Mills. But it's more than that, because they get into this, you know, didn't complete and didn't prosecute the work.
If this case actually went to trial, those wouldn't really be issues, would they?
Part and parcel of their claim. And I guess, I mean, I suppose they could drop that component of their breach of contract claim, but the way it stands right now, the way they have it pled and the way they have asserted it, is that they intend to, they're suing Granite for Granite's failure to step in and prosecute the work, failure to complete the work, and failure to indemnify Janie Mills. So as they have it framed currently, I think it, I mean, I don't, unless that was to be dropped, it strikes me as it's more than just this indemnity issue that they raise.
You're saying their petition alleges that Granite failed to complete the work?
Yes.
On the project?
Yes. That's, I mean, it has three components. Their claim on breach of contract has three components. And a component of that, the third component, I believe, in their list is failure to indemnify. The first one, I believe, is failure to prosecute the work, and the second one is failure to complete the work, which are bonded obligations in the bond, which is what they base their claims on. But, I mean, we're dealing with a policy that favors arbitration. If arbitration, and I'm blanking on the language, if a clause is susceptible of an interpretation what would cover the dispute, arbitration is appropriate and a motion to compel should be granted. So, I mean, and again, I think probably the most fundamental way of looking at it, you have the surety who was intended, I mean, the whole reason that the surety has the bond that's incorporating the work order and incorporating the blanket agreement is to avoid any gaps. So if the surety is responsible, the surety's tied to the prime contractor, J. Mills in this case, just the same as NAMI would. It wouldn't make any sense for the surety to have bonded obligations that extend differently from or apart from and different from what its principal, NAMI in this case, would be obligated to do. So the whole point is that everything's wrapped up in one package where the surety's bound just the same way as NAMI is, and everyone knows what they're getting into. You have the chain of contracts incorporated. So you've got the master subcontractor agreement, the blanket agreement. You've got the work order issued under that, which incorporates all the terms of the blanket agreement. And then beyond that, you have the bond, which NAMI and J. Mills expressly incorporated the work order so that the project would not have gaps, so that Granite wouldn't be stuck out there isolated dealing with something that it wasn't intending to do. I mean, otherwise, by the logic otherwise, you would have a arbitration with NAMI, if NAMI wasn't bankrupt, to complete the work, indemnify J. Mills, and timely prosecute the work, and then you'd still have a lawsuit with Granite Ray. And that was never the intention. That was the whole point of, in the bond, working to incorporate the successive chain so there wasn't that gap. And I guess I'll end on the policy aspect again, because I think there are cases that show arbitration in these types of instances should control. There are Texas cases on the equitable estoppel argument, and there are cases on, although outside of Texas, admittedly, from federal appellate courts kind of going through this exact fact pattern on the incorporation by reference. And I see my light's on. So.
Any questions? Thank you. Toby?
May it please the court. There are two primary issues that needs to be decided. One is, did these two parties agree to arbitrate? The second is, even if they did, is the scope of the arbitration agreement, does it include the claims being made in this lawsuit? I do have one thing I want to say at the outset, since there were several comments about the presumption for arbitration. As it relates to whether an arbitration agreement exists, there is no presumption for arbitration. And I will give you two Supreme Court cases that say that. One is Davidson v. Weber. The next is N. Ray Kellogg. So once again, in determination of whether an arbitration agreement exists, there is no presumption of arbitration. Normal contract rules apply in determining if these parties agreed to arbitrate. And in my case, what I want to point out, determining if these two parties had mutual assent to arbitrate. I've mentioned Davidson v. Webster and N. Ray Kellogg. There's another, Rachel v. Weiss, a Supreme Court case. I think to properly understand these issues that are here today, these cases must be read very carefully. And I'm going to go through real briefly what I think are the major points of these cases. Davidson v. Webster. Number one, the court said there is no presumption favoring arbitration when determining whether an agreement exists. Number two, you have to look at the entire writing. It's the normal contract rules and harmonize to give effect to all provisions. Three, no single provision taken alone will be controlling. And importantly, that the court, sitting as de novo, in de novo review, can determine a writing as ambiguous, even if both the parties tell you it's not. And I think that's going to be important later on as I go through these arguments. I think Davidson is an important case because in the end, I think we have the same problem in this case as was in Davidson. The incorporation of these contracts is ambiguous. Nobody knows what was incorporated into this bond. And I'll go through the language a little bit later on. N. Ray Kellogg, Brown and Root. This is the seminal case on the issue of direct benefits estoppel. Now, there has to be mutual assent to contract. But there are cases where the court has basically implied mutual assent by using some exceptions. Direct benefits estoppel is one of these. Incorporation by reference can be one of these. The appellant also claims third-party beneficiary, but I don't think that that even applies, and I don't think that at least the Texas Supreme Court has adopted that federal exception. Going on, Kellogg, Brown, and Root. The arbitration presumption does not apply. That's in that case, too. State law determines whether a valid arbitration exists. Federal law has identified exceptions to the general rule that the party must have expressly agreed to arbitrate, and it lists some of those. And as it lists some of those, you'll see in there at one point it says even most federal courts have not adopted the third-party beneficiary exception. The premise of direct beneficial estoppel is set forth in N. Ray Kellogg Brown. And that's basically is when a non-signatory goes to enforce an agreement, he can't select the provisions to be enforced. So he can't select to enforce provisions and then totally deny that the arbitration provision applies in that agreement. And I think that's what's important here. The court went on to explain what direct benefits estoppel is. A couple of the comments they make, and I want to read these. A non-signatory cannot be compelled to arbitrate on the sole ground that but for the contract containing the arbitration provision, it would have no right to sue. And I think that directly talks to what he was arguing, that all these contracts are interrelated. The second thing the court said, and actually this is what the court concluded, Although a signatory's claim may relate to a contract containing an arbitration provision, that relationship does not, in itself, bind the non-signatory to that arbitration provision. So, those are the important parts in Ray Kellogg. Rachel v. Weiss, the other case that I told you about, that's also a direct benefits estoppel case. And I find that interesting as I was going through this because that is a trust case where a trust is trying to enforce an arbitration agreement in the trust against a beneficiary of the trust. And the court said that is proper. But they used direct benefits estoppel to do that. They didn't use the, quote, third-party beneficiary exception. That's the reason I brought that up, because I really don't believe it. I think those two exceptions are the same thing, because in the third-party beneficiary exception, if you read those federal cases that have interpreted it, it says the same thing the direct estoppel does, that if you seek to enforce an agreement that has an arbitration in it, you have to take the good with the bad. So I want to talk briefly about incorporation by reference, and I think there's some confusion here. Incorporation by reference as an exception to mutual assent means this. If a party incorporates an arbitration provision into its contract, even though they did not sign the agreement containing the arbitration agreement, they've incorporated and therefore they're bound. Okay, that's what this exception to mutual assent means. That's not applicable in this case. Granite Re and Namey are the ones that signed this performance bond that allegedly incorporated the work order. My client never signed the agreement or otherwise assented to the incorporation of its contracts into their contract. You can't assume mutual assent on my client by your unilateral acts. And I think this goes back to interpreting these contracts as just a general contract. There's no presumption. And what I thought about when I said this is, okay, could Granite Re go down? Let's just say the subcontract has a clause in it that says that Namey has to get a bond, a performance bond, and if they don't pay for it, then it's the responsibility of the contractor, my client. Could the performance bond that Namey contracted with come in through our contract and enforce that provision and make us pay for the performance bond? No. They couldn't do that. And by the same way, they can't do that with the arbitration clause either. So incorporation by reference, as it relates to mutual assent exception, just doesn't work. I want to go to the next exception that they have claimed, and that's direct benefits estoppel. Now, I've already given you the premise of this, and but what I want to make clear is under direct benefits estoppel, there has to be a valid arbitration agreement in the agreement. That's where incorporation by reference comes back in, and there's some confusion regarding that. In other words, this payment bond could have, I think it didn't, but it could have incorporated this arbitration clause. But even if it did, my client is still not subject to it because they didn't mutually assent to it under the incorporation exception to mutual assent. Okay? That doesn't mean the incorporation wasn't valid in and of itself. Okay? And for the direct benefits estoppel to work, that incorporation has to be valid in the first instance. My client says it wasn't, and it wasn't for a couple of reasons, one of which the actual language of the incorporation is so ambiguous you don't know what was incorporated. I mean, the language says that the work order, which is a separate contract from the blanket agreement, is defined as the subcontract for purposes of the performance bond. And then it goes on to say the subcontract. Oh, actually what it says is a copy of the subcontract is incorporated herein. Well, what does that mean? A copy wasn't submitted with it. I mean, does it mean the work order? Just the language of the work order? Coupled with the fact that Texas court cases that have talked about the incorporation by reference doctrine has stated that it has to be specific enough so that both parties understand the terms and conditions that are being incorporated. I can't say that happened in this case. Yes, they incorporated the work order, and they say the work order incorporated the blanket agreement. Is that specific enough? Is that clear enough that you can say that all the parties understood the terms and conditions of the blanket? I don't think so. And I think that's a determination that this court is going to have to make. Now, even if this court finds that all of that's true, that this incorporation upon a corporation works and actually gets this arbitration agreement into the performance bond, which is being sued on, the language of the actual agreement itself excludes indemnity claims. Now, I know there was some discussion about that earlier. The performance bond is an indemnity obligation. That's all it is. When you sue them for breach of contract, you're suing on an indemnity obligation. That's all this performance bond is. And it can't be anything else. And what I guess that the appellant wants this court to do is say, okay, that exception doesn't exist because there's a valid arbitration agreement. Well, if this court...
Well, isn't that exactly what the contract says? It says, provided that the contractor may elect at any time not to arbitrate...
Yes, ma'am.
...a claim for indemnity...
Correct.
...against a party...
Mm-hmm.
...which whom the contractor does not have an enforceable arbitration agreement.
Yes, ma'am.
That's exactly what it says.
Exactly what
so
it says.
So they're asking us to enforce the contract as the provision is written. You're asking us to exclude that part that says... does not have an enforceable arbitration.
No,
agreement.
Ma'am, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking this court to construe this provisions under the auspices of normal contract law, which says you can't exclude this provision or you can't have an interpretation of the provision, let me say that, that would make one of the provisions non-existent. And his interpretation would do that because then all any person that had an indemnity claim had to do was incorporate the contract into whatever contract they're doing. And that means this provision would never be enforced. It could never be enforced. And if you interpret the whole provision under normal contract rules, it is clear, at least to me, as I'm reading this, that these parties never intended when they did this that a surety was going to come in and use this provision. I mean, there are several instances in the arbitration provision itself where they specifically identify, for instance, they specifically identify a claimant under the arbitration provision as either J. Mills or Namie. Surety is not listed
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I read that part of your argument too, but there's another place where a guarantor steps in. A guarantor is not named. So well, you can't say that, well, they only meant for it to be Mills or Namie if, in fact, they expressly say the guarantor can step in as well.
I'm not sure that's true, what you just said, because the guarantor would have signed the contract. If you look at the back of the subcontract, there is a specific signature line for the guarantor. So the guarantor would have signed this agreement.
Right, but your argument was that because they used specific language about who arbitrates to say the claimant, whether contractor or design slash build subcontractor, and you say that's Namie mm-hmm. and that's Mills.
Mills,
okay. But, and you say because they keep naming them that way, clearly the arbitration agreement says should be construed as only between those two. But yet Article 15 of that same agreement says the guarantor steps in. So the guarantor is not the contractor or the design/build subcontractor.
Yes, ma'am. And I think you need to look at the whole agreement, and you have to interpret the entire agreement. It was clearly the intent of the parties by adding that language inside this agreement that a guarantor would be subject to this particular clause. And I think the language, I don't have it
right.
in front of me.
It's in Article 15, and it clearly says that. But doesn't that other article that you were talking about, paragraph 12.1, also do that? Because paragraph 12.1 says that Mills may elect at any time not to arbitrate for indemnity against a party with whom he has not an enforceable arbitration agreement.
Yes, ma'am.
So what he's saying, what they're saying there in the converse is, if you have a valid enforceable arbitration agreement, then it is subject to arbitration. That's the converse of that.
Yes, ma'am. I agree with that.
Okay. So if they, if there is a valid, if there is an, I don't want to say valid because the, it uses the word enforceable. If there is an enforceable arbitration agreement by whatever theory that they have, whether it's an incorporation theory or the third party, the direct benefits argument, then they are Mills is required to arbitrate because it's an enforceable arbitration agreement.
It is an enforceable arbitration agreement.
Even though it is indemnity.
But I guess that goes back to the fact that, and I guess I see what you're saying. You're saying that if this court finds that the incorporation happened as it did.
Or that there's a direct benefits employment estoppel argument that's valid.
Well, there, that is an argument. And what I would say is if you interpret the contract like that, then you are totally nullifying this provision, and anybody with an indemnity claim could just incorporate this unilaterally without my client's consent and nullify this provision. I don't think that was the intent of the parties, and that I don't think that was the intent when they wrote this. Where somebody else could come in and unilaterally incorporate a document that nullifies this provision. And I see what you're saying, I really do, but I just don't think you can interpret it under normal contract rules like that, because that would give a third party the ability to come in and change the intent of the agreement. I mean, we got to figure out the intent of the agreement.
Doesn't the blanket agreement specifically provide that there are no third-party beneficiaries to the agreement, that it's only an agreement between Mills and NAMI?
And the guarantor, if the guarantor signed the agreement. Yes, ma'am. There is a signature block for the guarantor. If the guarantor signed the agreement, it would actually be a party to the agreement. So I guess I agree with you. There would be no third parties. Yes, ma'am.
Anything else? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Carson, is there a rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay.
Justice Gabriel, I did want to point out on the in the clerk's record, you asked about the issue of direct benefits estoppel being raised in the trial court. So I have citations in my brief, but on the clerk's record 56, footnote 7 is where you'll find that in the clerk's record. And the reporter's record, it starts at page 6, line 24. I want to touch on a few things real quick.
The place you raised it was in a footnote?
What?
The only place you raised it was in a footnote?
And at the argument.
And at the argument.
Yes. The third-party beneficiary issue is really, it is an exception to the non-signatory issue, but that's not what we rely on. The only way third-party beneficiary really arises here is that J. Mills is a third-party beneficiary under the bond. It's not a party to the bond. The only people that are parties to the bond are NAMI and Granite. J. Mills is the obligee. The only rights that it has is as a third-party beneficiary. So I guess I want to try to make that distinction. We're not claiming that we're a third-party beneficiary of the blanket agreement. That's not what's at issue. We have the incorporation by reference and the direct benefits estoppel. On direct benefits estoppel, we're also not, I mean, the way that doctrine works is just the fact that a claim is based on a contract doesn't get you there. But if the claim is based on a contract and you're trying to see, and you're trying to derive a direct benefit from that contract, you're bound to the contract. And our position is, again, J. Mills is trying to derive a direct benefit from the blanket agreement, the work order, which is incorporated by the bond. The only way Granite has any exposure at all is if NAMI breached those underlying bonded contracts. The mutual assent argument throws me off a little bit because, I mean, arbitration agreements aren't special. You interpret them like you do any other contract. So if the issue is the arbitration clause doesn't have mutual assent, then the question arises, does the underlying contract even have mutual assent? Because you can't pull out a clause and say, that doesn't have mutual assent, but the rest of the contract's all binding. Therefore, I can enforce all the rest of it, but I'm not bound by that part. I don't see how that works. On the anticipation that J. Mills never expected Granite Ray to be arbitrating with them, again, that the bond is an issue between NAMI and Granite. J. Mills didn't require a form of bond. NAMI and Granite were free to come up with their own bond form. They sought to incorporate that chain so there's no gap. It's J. Mills that's suing on that bond. They didn't have a say. They could have had a say in the negotiation if they had wanted to tie their subcontractor to a specific form, but they apparently elected not to do that. And we're not talking about just someone else incorporating. This idea that anyone can come in and incorporate and arbitrate strikes me as a lot, because we're not talking about just someone else. We're talking about a surety. We're talking about a surety who stands in the shoes of its principal. If it's in default, it's liable on the bond. It stands in its shoes and is tied to all those obligations. It's not just some random person that has incorporated the subcontract. There was a business reason. There's a legal reason. All of those things flow into that. It's not just a random party. Again, there are, I'll refer to the court to the citations in the brief. I've tried to do a summary of relevant cases for you so you can see that there are similarities, very close factual similarities to the issues on incorporation by reference from other courts, as well as the equitable estoppel, direct benefits estoppel argument from a Texas court, from the Austin Court of Appeals. There is guidance there, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. The whole incorporation of chains when you're dealing with sureties, common in the construction industry. Courts from across the country will show that. Texas has addressed the direct benefits estoppel in a bonded contract, and that's offered to you for consideration as well. And I'll end there unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
How did you get here?
By car.
Wow.
It took a while.
Where did the weather get bad?
The weather was actually okay. Up until about an hour south of Fort Worth is when you started seeing sheets of ice fly off of 18-wheelers and things like that. But it wasn't. Y'all did a very good job of keeping people updated on your website, so I was able to time it all right. So it was, everyone was very curious.
Well, we were concerned about lawyers' ability to get here, so I'm glad you made it safely, and we appreciate your argument. Very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, or if you want to hang around and hear the next case or two cases, you're